Okay, welcome to Happy Valley City Council work session. Today is Tuesday, November 20th, 2018. We will go over our regular agenda and then back to our work session items first. So any questions on our consent, which is inclusive for you of work session and regular session from October 16th, Resolution 1855, the IGA with Clackamas County regarding the road jurisdiction. Any questions on that? Take it off. 1856. Any questions on that? No. Okay, the next item is presentation from Vern Duncan Green Team. I would imagine they're gonna be here with probably a handful of students. I'm assuming not the entire class, or their green team is probably made up of a few kids. Any questions on that? You guys got the information in your packet, the letters, the response I had, okay. Public hearing ordinance number 541. Annexation of the four road segments. Any questions for staff before the meeting to get that ready? Okay. And then, of course, the Eagle Landing quasi-public hearing. Any questions? And then we're going to have the action item, the vehicle registration fee letter, which there was a draft in your packet. Any changes that you might see forthcoming, have those prepared for staff for the regular meeting. Okay.
And when it comes to that item, if if the council wants to move forward, then it'd be helpful to take a vote.
Yep.
Or
okay.
To not.
Whether or not we were going to submit. Yeah. Okay. So now back to work session, which is City of Happy Valley Infrastructure Revenue Forecast. Mr. Tuck.
Thank you. Good evening. First of all, I'd like to introduce again Nick Popenick. Tiberius Solutions. He was here a few weeks ago and talked to us about urban renewal. They've tightened up some of the numbers and have a report for us to look at. Primarily what we're focusing on is the East Happy Valley area kind of bleeding over into the Pleasant Valley North Carver area. Some council directed staff to start looking at an infrastructure financing program for 172nd and the infrastructure needs out to the east. So this is a part of that. We knew that we're not going to have enough money in systems development charges to build out the infrastructure that we need. So the other tool that is very common to do this in cities is urban renewal districts. So you had that presentation. This kind of takes it to the next step. Travis handed out a basically our capital improvement priorities and project needs. This is not the full list. It's just to give you an idea of the kind of numbers that we're talking about. Some of this is citywide, not specific to East Happy Valley or Pleasant Valley. So what we'll need to do if the council wants to move this item forward into a next phase of evaluation is we would represent this information in a more comprehensive manner. So that you can pair that up with the projected revenue against what these expenses could be. One other item to note, urban renewal districts, sometimes they're a little political, so early on, if the council wanted to continue the evaluation, I would recommend that staff then start talking to the taxing districts before we launch into a full process, just to kind of hear their concerns and see what we can talk through. So I'll turn it over to Nick and he'll run through the presentation.
Okay, thank you. So again, Nick Popenick, Tiberius Solutions. You can tell by the Spartan title slide of the presentation that we are a numbers firm. So when I was here last month with Elaine Howard, there was a visual presentation. That was what Elaine brings to the table. She's got the sort of outreach and the big picture about urban renewal. This presentation is entirely about numbers. This is the financial projections from now through 2040. I think for the urban renewal area, we actually go to 2045. But looking at the next two decades, how much revenue are we anticipating from system development charges? And then if you were to create an urban renewal area, how much revenue would that bring in as well? This might turn it on first.
Yeah.
That probably helps. There we go. So system development charges, I assume everybody is familiar with them, but they are a one-time fee on new development. the SDCs that we included in this analysis were limited to transportation, parks, and storm drainage. There are other SDCs that are charged inside Happy Valley for water and wastewater, but those are charged by separate jurisdictions that control those funds for investing in their own water and wastewater infrastructure, so we did not include those in this revenue forecast, although those jurisdictions could probably piggyback off of this work to use our growth forecast to forecast the amount of SDCs from those. Urban renewal, this slide was one that we had last month when we were here. Again, just illustrating the fundamental concepts of urban renewal. When you create it, you have the frozen base. Any tax revenue that's generated from the property values as they are today continues to go to the overlapping taxing districts. Any revenue generated by increase in assessed value, that increment goes to the overlapping taxing districts, or goes to the urban renewal area instead of the overlapping taxing districts. That is foregone revenue. That's money that those other taxing districts have to give up for a period of time. That is why it can be a political conversation and why creating an urban renewal plan requires collaboration with those affected partners. The ideal, as illustrated in this chart, is that through the use of urban renewal and the infrastructure and economic development projects that you invest in, you increase tax revenue above and beyond what would have happened without urban renewal. And by doing that after the urban renewal area closes down, everybody winds up being better off than had urban renewal not been used. So that is the ideal use of urban renewal, but that is not guaranteed, and it depends on which projects you select and the characteristic of the specific urban renewal area. For this analysis, what we were asked to do is the bottom bullet point, calculate SDC and TIF revenues. That is actually a relatively easy part of the assignment. The harder part was forecasting the growth in new development that fuels those forecasts. And for that, we had to go through a series of steps, defining the urban renewal area boundary that we wanted to look at, taking the Metro 2040 growth forecast as our base, aligning the geographies. So Metro did those forecasts a few years ago. If you look at their citywide numbers, the city boundaries that existed then are not the same as the city boundaries that exist today, and not the same as the city boundaries that will exist several years from now as annexations continue to occur. So we look at the disaggregated Metro forecast, which takes place on the TAS level, the Transportation Analysis Zone, and that map of all these TAS areas doesn't align nicely with the exact city boundaries and certainly doesn't align nicely with a hypothetical urban renewal area. So there's a process to try to align all those boundaries as best as possible so we can plug the forecast into our results. Additionally, the Metro forecast just gives us one lump number down in the year 2040. We convert that to an annualized forecast so we can see how this money would come in over time. And the Metro numbers, we don't want to just take at face value. So we looked at historical trends and talked with city staff and local developers to better understand and make sure that our projections really seemed like they were in line and weren't being too aggressive, fueled by just the Metro forecast. And along the way, there's a host of other assumptions that needed to be determined. Most importantly, the Metro numbers are forecasts of households and employees. But in order to forecast SDC revenues and urban renewal revenues, we need to know real market value, assessed value, built square feet, impervious surface area, what type of housing unit, all these other kinds of assumptions. And so we had to make choices to feed into our forecast on those fronts. The first step was really identifying what urban renewal area boundary we wanted to take a look at. So on the screen, you can see the proposed boundary, a little bit looking like Swiss cheese. And part of that is because there are limitations on how much of the city can be included within an urban renewal area. So an urban renewal boundary can't include more than 25% of a city's acreage or assessed value. This particular configuration is about 20% of the city's acreage, only 6% of the assessed value because it has a lot of vacant, low-value land within it. That 20% is relatively a sweet spot for cities creating urban renewal areas because it does allow you some wiggle room to amend the boundary in the future. If you max it out all at once, and then you wind up having a great development opportunity or a project that's just across the road, you can't bring that additional property in. I'll turn it over to Travis or others to explain a little bit more about what makes this particular area special in terms of its development potential and the projects that are needed here.
I think Michael and I can kind of chime in, but the initial take we did on the boundary was trying to go around developments that have already been completed. You're not going to see the growth and increment that you will on undeveloped properties, so that was one. Another one is we wanted to include the Pleasant Valley villages. That's right on the brink of getting started, and there's a significant amount of growth that could happen there in the future, and we could pick up that value. Other properties are undevelopable or public or just not inside the city. So I don't know, Michael, if you had anything else to add.
Michael Walter, Economic and Community Development Director. I'd just like to quickly say that Rock Creek Employment Center to the south there is, Jason just a few minutes ago spoke to, just starting to take off. Well, same thing with Rock Creek Employment Center. First industrial building getting ready to break ground. food processing facility. A space G is their exact name, specialty foods. So just on the cusp.
So that's the boundary we looked at, and again, this is not anything that's set in stone. This was the first cut, and this allowed us to identify what the frozen base of that area is and how much growth based on that metro forecast we anticipate to happen inside of that area to give us a preliminary look at what the financial capacity of an area with that boundary would be. And again, this is sort of the first step for you all to decide whether you'd like to investigate urban renewal any further. When we look at the results of our forecast in comparison to history, we could see that for residential development, historically there's been about 265 units per year. That's going back to 2003. That's a fairly long time series. And you can see that there have been economic prosperity and economic recession that occurred during that particular time frame. And so it is a bit of a roller coaster. The graph for this current year makes it look as though it's headed into another recession, but that's just because it's partial year data that we have there. So I wouldn't be too concerned about the one drop in the bar that we have this most recent year. If we looked at the metro forecast, the disaggregated numbers, and then aggregate them up with the current city boundary, it shows over 350 units per year forecast going forward. When we look at the historical data, and we think about the good two boom times that were covered in that history, and the fact that that still only got us 265 units per year, and we think about trying to sustain this level of development for the next 20 years, that level of residential development seemed as though it was a little too aggressive. So we ratcheted down the metro forecast numbers by about 25%. That got us to 250 new units per year, a little bit less than the historical trend. So that is a underlying assumption in our forecast going forward, just slightly less than historical. Yeah.
Question, Markley, Council. 218, I know the numbers are lower. So what period does that cover for 2018? Assume you're doing calendar year.
Yeah, it's calendar year information, and I think it was probably in June when I received this data, because I've been working on this forecast for a while. So I think it's been the last several months of permits have not been incorporated into that information. So we can definitely, we're getting close to the end of the calendar year, so we could update that and show a clean looking slide that shows what the total is once the year is over. When we get to the forecast of employment development, first off, the bullet point at the top, that shows the metro forecast of 177 employees per year. But the forecast that we care about is gross square feet. And when we're trying to compare to historical, gross square feet, again, is information that the city has their hands on. City building permit data can tell you how many square feet was built in any given year. Much harder to say how many employees moved into the city on any given year. So the chart is showing the built square feet. You can see it is even more of a roller coaster because you can have some years where you have a massive employment development, and then other years where there's virtually nothing. On average, over that period of time, we have seen 52,000 square feet per year of employment construction. When we look at the Metro forecast of 177 new employees, and we try to convert that into gross square feet per year, we look at a range of different data sources that try to tell us, on average, how many square feet are associated with an employee. And that is a tough analysis, because if you're building a warehouse versus building a hotel versus building a city hall, the number of employees per square feet varies dramatically, anywhere from 150 to maybe 1,500, you know, an order of 10 to 1. On average, when we look at sort of the lit review of other studies that have been done across the country on this front, we get a number around 350. And when we use that 350 square feet per employee number, we get this forecast, which shows 62,000 square feet per year, which is not too much more than what the city has been experiencing historically. And so we chose to stick with that forecast and not to try to make any further adjustments to the Metro numbers. We did try another method of identifying how many square feet per employee, looking at a couple of regional data sets for built square feet of existing employment buildings in the city, and then census data for how many existing employees are in the city. And using that information, we had a number of over 800 square feet per employee. It's possible that the data was incorrect or had a few outliers. It's possible that the type of industries that you had developed in the past were lower intensity, lower density of employment than the predominant building types we're seeing going forward. In any case, we chose not to go with that $800 square foot figure because that would seem like a heck of a lot of new construction going forward compared to the historical average. So those last two slides about the number of new housing units and square feet of employment development are sort of the heart of the forecast, but then we have to translate those into the other more nuanced figures that we need. The first is taking the total number of housing units and dividing it up by type. So for that, we're looking at single-family detached homes, attached homes, and then multifamily product. The assumptions that we have up there are looking at changes that have occurred over the last two decades and trying to extrapolate where we're headed over the next two decades. We looked at the historical data, and going back from, I think it was 2001 through 2010, so we think about the previous building cycle, 90% of the residential units that were built in the city were single-family detached, overwhelming. We look at from 2011 until now, and it's down to 58% of the new units being built are single-family detached. Huge difference in the composition of housing units from the last cycle to the current cycle. And this is consistent with what we're seeing all across the region based on consumer preferences, but largely on the just market factors, the cost of building homes, the cost of land, and what people can afford. When we think about going forward, we think that that trend will continue to be towards away from single-family detached homes and to more condos and multifamily product. And so that's reflected in the assumptions that we have up there. An important point with that is that SDC rates are different for those types of development, as well as the amount of assessed value that comes from those different types of units. And so if you had more construction in the future that had more single-family detached homes, there would be more revenue associated with that type of development. So this forecast may be a little conservative on the revenue because it may be a little aggressive in thinking about what types of new units are built here in the future. Also on the value of those units, we looked at all of the existing homes in the city and the number of multifamily units, divided that by the total real market value reported by the assessor for all of those properties to come up with an assumption per unit. It's a little over $400,000 per unit for single family and then $160,000 for multifamily. A critical thing when we're converting that into assessed value for our forecasts is that the state's property tax system does not make your original assessed value equal to your construction cost or the real market value of your home. There is a change property ratio that's applied to that. That change property ratio has a pretty big difference today, and so it's 68% for single family and down to 60% for multifamily. So if somebody comes in and builds a $10 million apartment complex, the assessed value on that is only going to be $6 million. So something to keep in mind as we're doing our forecast. On employment, we talked previously about the gross square feet of 350 per employee is what we used in our analysis. When we look at data that is available region-wide, we can get an imp- pervious square feet per employee. This is only useful for when we're calculating the storm drainage SDCs, but 810 square feet per employee. And then on our value assumptions, we looked at that a couple of different ways, but we settled on $162 per square foot for the new construction. That has an assessed value of 114, again, because of the change property ratio. And then for every new employee that comes in, we're anticipating that equates to around $40,000 of new assessed value. If you're looking at your packet that was delivered last week, it may say a different number there. It may say $90,000. As we were preparing for this presentation, since that packet was assembled, we realized that that was based on an old assumption. So when we talked previously about the square feet per employee, we had that historical current number for properties today of 816 square feet per employee. That number had gotten into the analysis, and that led to the $93,000 per employee of new construction. We think that number is too high. We caught that as our last go around, so we've edited the documents. The PowerPoint up on the screen has this edited number, but your packets may be out of date. But the city has the new updated report on that front, and it was not a catastrophic change to the numbers that we're looking at here. So when we look at the amount of growth overall, this is segmented to show citywide growth versus the growth inside the urban renewal area. You can see the number of new housing units and the number of new employees each year, and the total from now through 2040. You can also see the total gross square feet of employment forecast during that period of time, and the impervious surface area. So that's just sort of a summary slide of our growth forecasts. This next slide shows how that equates into the assessed value growth. Again, if you look at your packet, the assessed value growth for employment is going to show higher than what we have on the screen. So that was an error. The screen shows our final forecast. It is smaller, but in either situation, when you're looking forward at your community, the vast amount of real market value growth and assessed value growth is anticipated to come from residential development. It's residential development that's going to be driving any urban renewal area that you have here. And all told, during that forecast period, we are looking at citywide $1.6 billion of new assessed value coming on the tax rolls during this point in time. That's in today's dollars. So a lot of growth forecast for the community.
Question.
Councilor Drake.
The urban renewal period is 20 years?
So this shows the growth in terms of the Metro forecast, which was 20 years. I mean, Metro forecast, I think, was actually done in 2015 originally, so it was a 25-year forecast. Our urban renewal area that we'll get to in a minute when we show the TIF revenue, we actually forecast a little beyond that 2040 threshold. So we forecast a 25-year urban renewal area,
okay,
which is a fairly common time frame, but it can certainly be longer or shorter than that.
Okay, thank you.
Councilor Sherman.
The projections for the impact of the urban renewal area versus citywide, are they just a pro rata number, or do they take into account like the type of land and where the houses have already been zoned and things like that?
Right, so this forecast takes into account the amount of growth in each of the transportation analysis zones that Metro had forecast. So we showed earlier that the urban renewal area was about 20% of the city's acreage. It is a little over a third of the growth and assessed value that we're showing here, because those transportation analysis zones where the urban renewal area is are the ones that do have the higher potential for growth. The model that we built for this does have the ability to overwrite the assumptions for each of those little geographies to enter in however many units you think might happen in a given year in a given area. So there is the option to look at specific development scenarios of subdivisions coming online this year or that year and see how that would affect the numbers as well.
Okay, thank you.
So when we start to get to the actual monetary results, for the SDCs, we see that going forward, we're forecasting a little over $4 million of SDC revenue per year. From now through 2040, that adds up to $95 million. $95 million sounds like a lot of money, but not when you compare it to all of your capital costs that you have over the next 20 years. Also, there are the restrictions on the use of these funds, so they can only be going to capacity expanding projects and only for the types of infrastructure that they are collected for. So transportation and parks and recreation have a decent amount of revenue forecast here, but other types of infrastructure project that don't fit so nicely into those categories or that aren't on the SDC project lists, that's where we have problems, as well as timing problems, because that money isn't all available today. That is over the course of the next 20 years. Our TIF forecast, I'm not going to have you look at this table. It's in your packets so that you can refer to it later if you want to, but we'll look at charts instead for the most part. So this shows the forecast of TIF revenue going forward. Again, like all urban renewal areas, pretty limited revenue in the early years, but does grow significantly over time based on those forecasts of new growth in the community. You can see when we get out past 2040, the trajectory changes. That's because that's when we get beyond Metro's forecast. And in our model, we just turn off future growth at that point and say, this urban renewal area will be all built out by then, and we'll just be getting 3% appreciation after that point in time. And again, this does show a 25-year period of collecting revenue. Not that it has to be 25, that's not a magic number. That is just a reasonable number given other communities that I've worked with across the state. That is tax increment revenue, but tax increment revenue only really tells a piece of the story when it comes to the ability for urban renewal areas to invest in projects. They almost always incur debt to accelerate the timing of investments and then use that TIF revenue to pay interest on the debt that's incurred. So when we show a hypothetical borrowing plan here, this shows what would happen if the urban renewal area borrowed as much money as possible every 5 years, assuming 20-year terms and 1.5 times coverage ratio and a 5% interest rate, and then the amortization periods ratcheting down over time as we get closer to the end of the urban renewal area so that everything can be paid off 25 years from now. So when we look at that pattern, you can see that you have spikes. Every few years, you're going to have the ability to go out and fund some significant infrastructure project, but then you'll have several quiet years where you're pretty limited in what you can spend your money on because most of it is going to pay for the debt service of the projects that you've already built. And another key thing to notice on this chart is that the first 5 years, really up until 2025, so it's 5 years of tax revenue, but that's 7 years from where we are today, the capacity is relatively limited. So urban renewal is not a get-rich-quick scheme. This is a long-term investment that we're talking about here. And then a summary table just to help break down those numbers even more. Over that 25-year period of time, we're looking at $206 million of tax increment revenue. Again, in your packet, it says something different. That $206 million in revenue, we adjust it to account for discounts and delinquencies and compression, rate truncation, all these other things. You're not going to get every dollar that is calculated by the assessor. So that comes down to $196 million of net TIF. From that, a portion would wind up going to pay for interest on debt, so it's not available for capital projects. So the amount that would be available for capital projects is the maximum indebtedness of $164 million. And that number is in a nominal year of expenditure future dollars. So if you convert that back into constant 2019 dollars, you're looking at $105 million in terms of the actual borrowing capacity when compared to current cost estimates for projects. And that $105 million, if you break it into five-year chunks, you can see in the first 5 years of the urban renewal area, you'd have about $10 million of capacity. And then every 5 years after that, you'd have capacity for another $20 to $25 million of projects. And so when we talk about how long of an urban renewal area, this shows 25 years. Could be more or less. If you shorten it by 5 years, you'd give up $22.9 million of availability to fund projects. But you would be done with it 5 years sooner, which puts all the extra money back onto the tax rolls that much sooner. So that's the sort of trade-off when you're looking at how long and how many projects you can fund with urban renewal. Implications of the analysis. We show that there's about $4.3 million in SDC revenue. That is a significant funding source for the city going forward, but it is restricted and it is insufficient to cover the full list of projects that the city has going forward. $105 million in funding from urban renewal over an assumed 25-year period. So that's very significant. Again, more than doubles the amount of funding capacity compared to your SDCs, but there are trade-offs. It's no free lunch there. The good thing about urban renewal is that it does not increase taxes on property owners, but that's also the bad thing because it does require that division of taxes from the overlapping taxing districts. These numbers are all looking at your long-term funding ability, but your long-term funding ability might not address all of your short-term needs, and that leads to that next bullet point about more nuanced financial planning required to be able to really put these revenue sources on this timeline together with the list of desired projects that you want to fund and see which projects look like they have sufficient funding in the desired time frame and which ones don't, and how can urban renewal help that? And even with urban renewal, you know, where are still the pressure points in terms of being able to fund the infrastructure that the community wants and needs? And then the last bullet point, all of this is based on that underlying forecast of future development, and that forecast is uncertain. We didn't try to predict future economic cycles, but there will be another recession and there will be another recovery, and depending on the severity of those and how the market responds, you know, all this is a good estimate going forward, but the individual annual revenue amounts are going to change based on those market factors. Last slide here is about creating urban renewal area. I think we had this slide at the meeting a month ago. If the city council decides that they do want to move forward with it, it's not an overnight process. There will be lots of public outreach. Usually an advisory committee is created, several public meetings are held. That's where you refine and confirm your urban renewal boundary that you want to look at, along with the list of projects that you'd like to fund, and agree on those expectations for how long the urban renewal area should be in place and how much it's going to be able to fund over that period. A critical piece during that is the outreach to the affected taxing districts, the folks who are going to have to forego revenue in order to make this work. And there will be official public meetings, hearings that will take place, both of the urban renewal area, which is urban renewal agency, which is probably this group wearing different hats, as well as planning commission, and then city council again for the ultimate decision making on that. So lots of opportunities for folks to make their opinions known when it comes to adopting an urban renewal plan. So with that, is the end of the official presentation, and just turning it over to all of you for questions or to discuss yourselves about the implications of this going forward.
Thank you, Nick. Steph, anything to add?
Just as you continue with the conversation, the next steps would be to take this, integrate our project list, capital improvement list with all the costs, and as Nick said, kind of target some time frames on that, married up with SDC collections and urban renewal, and kind of see how this could all work out. And then I'd just schedule it for a work session in a few months once we get that work done.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thoughts?
Sounds good. Looking forward. Very nice. Next steps.
Councilor Sherman?
Yeah, so it seems like, I mean, with the exception of the overlapping taxing districts that are going to give something up temporarily, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the only other pushback from the public would be just the education portion of helping them understand why it looks like their taxes went up when it really it didn't. I mean, are there any other things from a public perspective that this would impact them in a negative fashion at all? I mean, potentially it would be a positive for our residents, wouldn't it? Because we're building infrastructure to create.
So urban renewal over the decades and decades that it's existed has gotten a bad name in other more urbanized areas for displacement of residents, and primarily those of color. This area that we're looking at is undeveloped, so or largely undeveloped, so I don't think it has the same kind of connotation that in maybe bigger urban areas may see. So I think you nailed it. It's taxing districts and it's education about the tax bill looking different.
Councilor Sherman?
And I would think that from a timing perspective, doing this prior to the build out of like Pleasant Valley Villages to the industrial area, this is the optimal time to be looking at this, right? Before these higher tax rolls get locked in at whatever point you locked them in. Mm-hmm. I see a lot of nodding heads, so that's a good sign.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This is the time to do it if the council's going to consider it.
Okay. Council President?
What's the timeframe on this, from start to finish to get this?
So, if the city council were to say, create an urban renewal plan, for one, the work that's already been done on this feasibility study can get rolled into that, which helps expedite the technical analysis on it. But you still have to write the official plan document, do the outreach, and host the number of meetings that are required, and all the public notice that's involved in each of those, and the consult and confer process with the affected taxing districts. Elaine Howard, who I've worked with on a bunch, who leads communities through this process as a consultant, I'd say the fastest that she's able to go from day one of the city saying, yes, we want to create an urban renewal plan, to, all right, the urban renewal plan is adopted and in effect, is about 6 months. And that's the sort of streamlined, quick as you go, we already have our boundary identified, and let's, you know, hit the ground running. These processes can definitely take 9 to 12 months if there's a lot of public sort of visioning work that goes into it. I'd say the biggest thing is that you have a list of projects that are already pretty well defined and identified. Having that list of projects from the get-go can really help to accelerate the process, because you're not going out there just sort of looking at people's wish lists and trying to come up with new projects, but the city's already identified a list of major needs. And so you've got a really concrete idea that you could take to the public and get their feedback on, and that helps accelerate the process.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else?
No.
So do you have it scheduled for a work session?
Not yet, but I will. It'll be, well, things are starting to get stacked up for meetings, and we only have one meeting in January due to where the date falls, so it'll be a few months, but.
So you're talking end of 19, beginning of 20, before anything's in place if it was adopted?
Probably end of 19, yeah, start of 2020.
Okay. Yeah, it's ideal to have urban renewal plans adopted before October of a calendar year, because the frozen base is determined based on whatever tax roll data has been publicly released at the time that the plan is effective. And new tax roll data comes out in October. So, but if you were to get going on this plan, say in January or February of next year, that does give you enough time to get a plan adopted before next October. And it's not like it's the end of the world if things get adopted in November or beyond, but it is just a little bit nicer to be able to squeak in before that October deadline. It just accelerates everything and lets you fund your projects and close down the urban renewal area that much faster.
Okay. Anything else on that?
Good.
You're good?
Keep moving along.
Looks what it.
Okay, yeah.
Everybody's shaking their head.
All right. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. Report?
Manager's report. We are hosting the city's dinner in February, so start thinking of locations, potential venues, and kind of a program. Some have programs, some are, you know, have speakers from outside. So just be thinking about that. We will too. The council meeting schedule. So I'm proposing to cancel the December 18th meeting. I figured people would be busy that time of year, so I tried to schedule around that, if that's okay with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
First meeting, and the only meeting we have in January, is the 15th. The first Tuesday of the month is New Year's, so not having it that day. We're going to send out invitations and notices of the swearing-in ceremony that is planned for the 15th for re-elected folks, newly elected folks. Final item I had is we held the 9th annual Youth Town Hall, it was on November 14th. Had about 50 kids from the community show up. It was hosted by, facilitated by Eric Post, and everyone was really engaged, and some themes started coming from the kids out of that. They're stressed. They have a lot of demands on them with sports and academics and expectations and all sort of things. So we'll see if that translates into a project for the youth this year. But they're going to come to the council and present the findings of that and what they plan on working on the first part of the year in 2019.
do our councillor reports if there's any. Councillor Sherman?
Sure, I'll go. Thank you, Mayor. Let's see, so last few weeks I attended the Public Arts Committee. I did get feedback from the Public Arts Committee. They'd like to know if they can be involved or how they would be involved when, for example, they're doing an entrance monument at a new development or a roundabout art, and they want to know how they could be kind of part of that overall process. So I thought I'd say I would bring that up to council and to Mr. Tuck, and just for future consideration. Attended the Harvest Fest, Metro Parks and Nature, the last couple of stakeholder meetings, so they are going to go back and now, you know, make their recommendations back to the Metro Council, and I expect that we'll see bond in 2019. It's really interesting. They're going through that process. The difference this time from last time is this: they're going forward kind of with all their land acquisition through the lens of racial equity and serving or, you know, applying it to underserved communities. And one of the things I thought was really interesting from that, because my assumption was that just meant you find property in East Portland or Lentz and you buy it and you put parks in. And they got really significant feedback from a lot of the stakeholders saying that's the exact opposite of what you want to do. That building big park facilities, doing land acquisition in those underserved areas drives up property values, creates gentrification, moves the people of color out of those areas. So in fact, what they prefer to do is look for neighboring areas. And the example that they gave was like Pleasant Valley and out toward Gresham direction, and saying, as long as the areas have easy access, potentially can be on public transportation, that makes it a better utilization for the underserved communities than it is actually putting it there. So it was a different perspective than I had heard on previously on that. Attended Rotary. Went to our Reservoir 11 sneak peek for our new big hole in the ground. It's a pretty darn big hole in the ground. Took some city staffers for a hike, and then coming up we've got the All-State Ribbon Cutting, the Oregon Leadership Summit, and then Parks Advisory Committee. So that's about it.
Great.
In case you guys weren't aware, the last couple weeks was an election and a lot of campaigning, so I actually didn't have any events over the course of the last couple of weeks. I know, it's a rarity for me. I took a week and went to Puerto Vallarta, so had a good time in the sun. Coming up, all I have is the All-State ribbon cutting.
Councilor Drake?
Not too much to report in the past. I do the Feed the Homeless next week. It is the fourth Wednesday. It's kind of odd. Usually it happens before Thanksgiving, but because of the calendar, it happens next week. So we're doing that.
Okay. Council President?
I went to the HVBA council or meeting on 24th and the Skintique grand opening. And then I attended the Clackamas County 175th anniversary they had over there. I went to that. That was kind of interesting. I know there was something else, but I think that's it.
I don't really have anything to add. Sorry. Some of those things went to those, but nothing new. Okay, so we have about 15 minutes. I don't think there's anything else to, anything, any other concerns, councilors? Then we'll adjourn until regular meeting at 7 o'clock.